Episode 56.
A seller that feels like they've got a huge gold mine there, and it's who's the lucky person that gets to take over this, you know, for this price, $1 million, $1.5 million, whatever that might be. And, you know, they were not given the right information, unfortunately, on evaluating their business. It's not, like you said, it's not a business unless it can run by itself.
Welcome to an audio-only rebroadcast of a face-to-face video podcast. Face-to-face is a single-topic discussion with multiple guests in a video setting. Find the video replay to all face-to-face discussions on the face-to-face page on the Remarkable Results website. Hello, aftermarketers. Carm Capriotto here. Welcome to episode 56. Hey, have you ever said I would make a great guest on Carm's podcast? Well, please, don't be bashful. Be proactive and drop me a line. Get your story told. Email me at carm@remarkableresults.biz or go to the website. There's a contact tab and a feedback button. They all point back to me, and I welcome your consideration as a guest on the podcast. Now, episode 56, an audio-only rebroadcast of a face-to-face video podcast using the Blab live video conversation platform. Joining me are Jose Bueso, Andy Masol, and Jeff Matt for an interesting discussion on multi-shop ownership. Jose has 3 shops, Andy just got his first, and Jeff Matt has 6. It's a great discussion from their perspective on multi-shop ownership opportunities and challenges. Keep an eye on the face-to-face page for additional live video conversations. And yes, you can actually join the conversation live. All you need to do is on the website, subscribe to the feed, or you can listen and watch the replay later. This audio-only replay is for the convenience of our commuters and downloaders, listeners who want to listen on iTunes. In other words, it's awfully tough to watch a video replay when you're driving. Hey, thanks for being connected to the podcast. Here we go. Welcome to a face-to-face podcast. My name is Carm Capriotto with the RemarkableResults.biz website. And we got a great and interesting question today, or a subject, really. It's multi-shop ownership and the opportunities and challenge. And all 3 of my guests have either 1 or more shops. We have Jose Bueso in the bottom right-hand corner. Raise your hand, Jose. He's a partner in Dynamic Automotive in the Maryland, Washington, D.C. area. Along with partners Dwayne Myers and Lee Foreman, they've got 3 locations. I'm sure they each run one of them. Been a Motor Age Top Shop in 2014, and they're involved with the Auto Care Association with Car Care Professional Network, CCPN. This partnership team was just recognized with a Head of the Class Award from the Auto Care Association's Education Committee for companies that continually invest in their employee education and training. Hear Jose and his partners, Dwayne and Lee, in episodes 2, 3, and 4. Wow, that's about 50-some episodes ago, Jose. And I was just new to this thing, and I've known you guys in the past, and we've hung out together, and we just talked and talked and talked. So I had to break it up into 3 episodes.
Yeah.
Andy Masol, bottom left corner, raise your hand, second-generation owner from Kurt Service in Oak Park, Michigan. He was featured in episode 29, and he and his dad, Kurt, built their 15,000-square-foot dream shop in 2012. And you can hear all about the green capabilities of his shop in this episode. His main location focuses on specialized services such as European-Asian hybrid and fleet. Andy recently opened his first branch with a partner in a more rural setting, first time. Actually, I think we were doing the podcast, and I learned that firsthand. He and his partner, Jim, they were consulting for the business, but they said, why should we make it better for someone else? Let's just buy it. And so they bought it instead. He's also a member of CCPN and ASA. Jeff Matt, say hi, Jeff. Top right corner, at least on
Hello, my everyone screen.
Jeff's from Victory Auto Service in Minneapolis and, get this, St. Petersburg, Florida. And he was recently featured in just a few episodes ago in episode 48. Jeff owns 6 locations, with 1 being in Florida. Now, why would a Minnesotan have a branch in Florida? He has over 40 team members and has grown through acquisition. Jeff opened Victory in 1997 as a one-bay shop and has slow, steady growth over the years. And all my guests have very strong philanthropic causes in their community. So welcome, guys. I appreciate you coming on. What's the urge to want to grow? And you did it through partnerships, Jose. You did it with partnerships, Andy. Jeff, you've done that on your own. So I throw this question open. What says I want to do this? What's the internal urge?
Well, for me, the internal urge was to acquire commercial property, to gain equity, and to really put a foothold within the community that I was servicing.
Got it.
So that was really a drive for me. I wanted to cement the business in its place, so to speak. And that's just one of my ambitions, of course. I wanted to grow the business from a two-bay shop to something more than a two-bay shop. And I believe that we could clone ourselves, train our replacements, and duplicate what we've done over and over again in a successful manner.
So, would you continue to grow through finding a partner, or you don't need any more partners right now?
No, I think that right now, given our current size, we probably don't need another partner, but I'm not saying that I wouldn't entertain that.
Okay.
I wouldn't close the door, but knowing what we know now, what we've learned, I think that we could grow probably double in size, if not triple in size, with the current partnership.
And I have a great burning question later about, you know, the boomers who want to retire. And I'm sure that may come into what your strategy is, Jose. Andy, first time, a great legacy business with your dad. And he said, hey, if you want to branch out, go ahead. Am I right?
That was the short term to the long conversation that was there.
Sure it was. God, how tough it's got to be to, you know, to have a dad. Funny story. Andy and I were doing our interview, and we do it over Skype, and his dad kept coming in and out of the office. Wasn't quite sure what the heck was going on. that was a blast, because I come from a family business. I can appreciate that. So what was your urge to want to do this?
You know, my urge was, a lot of it was because working with my father, I mean, we over doubled the size of the business in, you know, sales wise and such, was from about 2002 to 2012 when I really got involved, and it just kept growing. Uh-huh. We went from a 7-bay facility to a 15-bay facility and did very, very well. And there was not a whole lot more room for growth at that single location.
Right.
So I wanted to entertain other areas and other growth. And I think there's huge opportunity for the reasons that you just mentioned, Carm, about the aging demographic of the shop owner.
Yeah.
So it started off just by helping somebody who was more of a challenged business owner who was struggling to get by. So had some extra time on our hands, and my partner James and I started consulting for him, and then slowly realized, like a lot of the things, I think it's hard for people to see that some of the biggest problems are at the behind the wheel of the ship. So after we had done that for about 3-4 months, it was actually the previous owner's idea. He said, why don't you guys just buy this from me? Let me out. So we weren't really looking. We weren't considering, but we were already invested for 3-4 months and said, well, if we can do this in two gigantic large operations in the city, we should be able to handle this under our wing. So
sure.
Kind of fell into it that way. It wasn't... later on, I knew that I always wanted to have more operations in multiple locations, but that was kind of falling into it.
Great. Now, Jeff, you started with a 1-bay shop, and yep. I mean, God, I'm sure you grew into multiple bays, but what you recall the day that the urge said, I'm going to grow?
Well, we didn't really have a strategy like thinking ahead that, well, someday we're going to have several locations. It really, we kind of stumbled into it, really. As you might recall in our interview, you know, the opportunity presented itself to purchase a property where we were renting, and we had a significant, huge fleet account that was coming to our one shop, and we really couldn't fit them into our second location.
Yeah, right. So
the discussion kind of went to, you know, can we operate two locations? Well, then once we got to that point, I think the discussion into why we are in multi-stores is that, you know, there's a lot of efficiencies in having multiple locations. I think having, you know, the specialty equipment that you need to have, having flexibility with your staff, it just seemed to make more and more sense as we had two stores and went into three locations. And then, then beyond that, just kind of feeling like, you know, if you're doing a good job, then, you know, this shouldn't be that hard to replicate as the opportunity presents themselves, you know.
How do you know when it's time to add another branch?
Well, for us, you know, we have to have a foundation. We have to have everybody in place. We have to have no loose ends and allow us to focus entirely on the next step. That seems to be, you know, the litmus test for us.
What do you mean, a good foundation?
Just stability. Stability, with all the core employees, managers, technicians.
And how have you found it? Opening branch two, then branch three, four. How do you know, what's the recovery time before you would even consider another branch?
For us, it seems like it's been about a year. Yeah.
About a year, huh?
Maybe 18 months, something like that. Okay. I know some people have got, you know, other agendas and budgets and whatnot. And, you know, for us, that's what we needed to have. We needed to literally take one step at a time, make sure the foundation was solid, and then move on. And I never at any point want to have a location just to have the location. We thought we decided internally that at any point where we felt like the overall quality was going backwards, that we were going to stop. So we wanted to make sure that we had that foundation of quality, good people that were carrying out the mission that we put before them. And, yeah. And when we did, we could move on.
Guys, anything on that?
No, I agree with that completely. I referred to training my replacement in many ways. That's what we did. We trained our replacements. These people became proficient with their skills. We had the right type of technical people repairing the vehicles, the right type of people in the office, the right type of people taking care of the back end, and we could branch out and develop another location. So our second location, much like he mentioned, we purchased a location from a location that we leased. We had doubled our size, which wasn't really too hard to do. We got those well-trained personnel to operate our primary location flawlessly. And we had that foundation, and we were able to expand that, and it just makes things a lot easier. Of course, financially, you have to be prepared to take on the acquisition. And at that time, with our particular location, we were able to amass a great amount of capital. So we had the funding, and we were able to buy the second shop, which had been closed for a year and a half. It was sitting idle, an empty shell, and had equipment in it. We were lucky enough. It came with the lifts, the compressors. It just needed sprucing up. We added some offices, and we bought this piece of property for less than what most people were purchasing homes for. Mm-hmm. There was no goodwill to buy. We slid right in. It was a no-brainer.
But you saw something there, Jose, that said, I can run a successful business. What were the things you saw?
Well, with the second location, of course, it was opportunity to expand our clientele base. And
the marketplace, the community, the demographics, were they strong for you?
Yes. This second shop was only 8 miles away from our first shop. And we thought that, okay, this is going to be a good location for us. This is going to expand our footprint. And as a result, it was in a more rural area, and it didn't launch as well as the first location. The first location, the demographics were excellent. Mm-hmm. And we got into that location. It was surrounded by high-end community, middle class, high middle class. These people were all commuters. They needed their cars worked on and fixed like yesterday. Mm-hmm. We had people knocking down our doors 3 days before we opened up. it was an instantaneous success. Within 30 days, that first location was in the black, and we never looked back. The second location, however, was in a much more rural area, and surprise, we had to work this location.
Yeah, is that Frederick, by the way, Frederick?
That was in Libertytown, the location I'm in right now.
Okay.
It's a sleepy little town by comparison to our new market location.
Were you prepared for that little struggle?
That was a surprise.
Ah.
And it took a few years to really get this place launched up. It was an excellent training facility, as it turned out.
Mm-hmm.
So within those 2 years, Dwayne Myers, my third partner, developed his skills here at this location and ran this location for the next, I would say, 5 years. And I went on to develop and build the Urbana location, our third location. But this location taught us a few lessons about location, location, location.
That was going to be one of my questions. Andy, let me ask you a question. This may be really personal. You can answer it if you don't want to. How is your rural location going? Does Jose's story sound familiar?
It sounds very familiar. It's you go from running a big shop that's in a metropolitan area to a sleepy little town that's in a very rural area, thinking going into it that it would be worlds easier, and there's all kinds of different challenges that are there. That location is doing well. It's doing better. It's growing, but it is definitely, when we doubled in size in a metropolitan area, we were able to fill that extra space with business relatively easily.
Right.
In a rural area, it's just a different way of doing business. But I very much hear what you're saying, Jose, and that's very similar to what we're going through now, and learn about a lot about locations. And we'll consider that, but for me, it works well because I have two shops that are on the opposite ends of the spectrum. So one is large metropolitan, one is much smaller in a sleepy little town like you referenced. And if I can develop processes and procedures that work well with those, I should be able to take everything else in between.
3, 4, 5. Jeff, does this sound familiar to you at all?
Well, we have a couple locations there on the outskirts as well. And yeah, there are definitely some challenges, you know, but you can definitely grow them. And if you've got good staff, you may have to be a little more patient with the process. But ultimately, you know, it's the same things over and over that make you successful. You know, taking care of the cars, keeping your promises, building relationships. And, you know, you can do that, I think, anywhere.
So you're saying is there's no star status. Nothing happens in 2 or 3 weeks. What happens is you just work your plan as hard as you possibly can when you see that stuff doesn't snap and come in, like, you know, wow, you're coming from this great, you know, $2 million place, and you're coming out and struggling to do $500,000, and you're saying, what did I do? Where's the Andy, Jose, Jeff magic? It's not here. What, you know, oh my God, it's going to be years. How am I going to get my money back? Sound familiar?
That goes back to the diversifying, you know, having multiple locations. You can have shops at different levels, and then you have one that's a little bit slower. You have to be a little more patient with. It's, you know, it's maybe like a stock or something. You just have to let it grow.
And to your point, the more branches you have, the more you can use the resources you have everywhere to, I guess if the profits are strong at one place, you can sustain the other one as long as you see that there is writing on, you know, on the wall that,
right.
that there is. Is it marketing? Is it the acceptance of new customers into a failing location? What's the biggest challenge? As an example, Andy, what's the biggest challenge?
Well, I think that one of our biggest challenges is, you know, we went into a business that was faltering badly for the last, you know, 5 to 7 years. Its sales were just a downward trend. And everything in the place needed a lot of work. So there was complete rebranding that needed to be done, which, again, we went into this without the initial intent of purchasing.
I see.
So we ran it under the existing branding for a while, but had seemed to find that that had a lot to do with it. You know, the image was not the best, and just having new owners there wasn't enough. So we had to change the look, change the branding, give it a totally new facelift, you know, put under new ownership. So it was a functioning shop, like you had mentioned, Jose, but I, looking back on it, having an empty shop to start, you know, versus taking something that was broken, then you have to fix it, then you have to grow it. It's two different things.
Unique challenges. Jeff, I think, Jeff, you've done this in the past, and I think your Florida location is one of those, you know,
exactly,
total fixes, right?
Yeah, it was. It had bottomed out quite a bit. But I think nowadays, I think it's actually probably a little bit easier to in these situations. Not that it's easy overall, but I think the processes are pretty condensed, maybe.
Mm-hmm.
So with the internet, it is really kind of the great equalizer. If you've got a great presence online and you build up your reputation and you have all of the website and the Google Plus page and all that stuff in place, you can definitely get on the map a lot faster. We've done that over and over as a much smaller location compared to some established, heavily advertised competitors, and really, I think, gotten noticed, and I'm sure they've noticed us as well, because you know, there's definitely some do's and don'ts when it comes to the internet marketing and your social media presence, all that stuff.
Excellent. Hey, this is a great dialogue. You know, I was going to ask questions about demographics. I think you talked a little bit about that, but has anyone ever gone in and, Andy, you probably said, okay, let's buy this thing. You got yourself a deal. Did you ever go out and find out what the income levels and the concentration of population was around your place that says, you know, I know we're going to stick money out here, but we do or don't have a chance because there's just not enough income, people, opportunity?
Well, we did do that, and throughout a lot of our marketing efforts, we did, even during the consulting phase of it, you know, we seen something very surprising is the other location my partner had was in Ann Arbor, you know, which is a big metropolitan area, then our location in Oak Park, and this location in the rural area by a numbers aspect, you know, had a much better medium household income, but it just did not have the density that I would say we were used to. So you have good clients, but just not as many of them to pull from. So I think a lot of it is about being flexible, you know, like Jeff had stated about having, you know, your core business and everything, you're running it the same way. One may grow faster than the other, but something that I know that the two of you have done, and you may be touching base on this a little bit later, Carm, is both of you have branded your facilities under the same brand and same name, where I initially was running it under the existing brand. And then for myself, I didn't really see the initial value in branding it the same as my location that was 25, 30 miles away. So I have them under two different brands, which that's
still do. You still do.
I still do currently.
Okay.
Yes.
Because your partner has his own place too.
Had his own place previously. It was a partnership in a different operation.
Okay. All right. Well, does that actually, you would probably sit here and agree that what Jeff and Jose are doing are smart by not having seven different brands, for example, for you, Jeff. I mean, that's the value.
That'd be a challenge.
And you talk about economies of scale for branding, for internet. I couldn't even imagine having multiple websites to manage that were all saying the same thing with a different name.
Right.
Whoa. Staffing. One of the biggest hurdles, staffing?
Yes.
Yeah. Without Agreed. A doubt.
So yeah. you don't even think of doing a place if you don't think you've got some backup paid staff that you could move around? Or do you, I know your Florida situation is completely different because, you know, you think about where you are. Jose, if you were going to expand tomorrow, you know, secretly you guys got something going. Would you be doing some build up to make sure that new branch was like smooth butter?
Yes.
It worked?
Yeah. Yes, you mean development?
Yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah, I would. And it's basically what we've done throughout our process, bring in more people, train them. And we're really big on education. Education is key to business success. And that's so important to develop people. And and have them shadow your experts that are already there and learn, you know, what to do and do it flawlessly.
And it's not just about the technology, it's about the culture, yes?
It's about the culture.
Yeah. It is about the culture.
You're developing the culture. And,
thank you.
And whether or not you're developing it, it's there. I mean, you've got a culture in your facility, whether you know it or not. It's there anyway. So well, you might as well set that tone for success.
We're going to do a podcast, a face-to-face podcast on culture down in the future. And I've got some names of some of my former guests that I want to have on, because it is the single largest business strategy axiom that any business can have today. And that is, if their people feel engaged and part of and love to come to work, you know, the old story is if you love what you do, you never work a day in your life. And so much of it has to do with you, the owners, in the kind of environment you keep them, your people happy. They keep your customers happy. It's just how it works. Yeah. Yeah, lots of buzz on the podcast of late about a quality culture. Besides bank financing, guys, what are other ways to finance a new branch?
Here in Frederick, and I just discovered this year, there are opportunities for a business person who has a model, and actually a working model of their future business going on. You can expose yourself to financial angels, and they have these opportunities that occur once a month at a high-end restaurant, and you can make your presentation. And these financial angels are in the room listening to you.
It's like Shark Tank.
Yeah. And you can make a deal with them. But I had no idea that this was available locally until just this year.
Yeah, but they want to be a partner, don't they?
Well, they want – most of the times they're into – from what I understand, I don't know a lot about it, because I've gone through the conventional – channels working with the banks, and it's usually the local banks. But from what I understand, they become a working partner or a silent partner. Yeah.
By the way, back in episode 2, 3, or 4, and I don't know which one it was, Jose, you guys, and I think it was Dwayne, spoke heavily about banking relationships. I mean, we talked about so many things back then, and I can't recall about, you know, there was a bank that just said to you guys, and they said, well, they lost in the new bank won. So yeah, it's important to have good banking relationships. I know, Jeff, you have got owner financing going, I think, as part of your strategy.
Absolutely.
Right?
Yep. Absolutely. Every time we've done it.
Okay.
It just seems to be the best win-win for the situations that I've experienced. You know, you don't need an appraisal. You don't need a third party opinion. It's literally, you know, left up to the discretion between the seller and the buyer on what is fair on each part of the transaction. And, you know, they don't probably want a lot of money down. They get tax implications. So you can craft something up. Usually, you know, again, probably not easily, but it's literally two people coming to an agreement, writing up a contract, and following through on it. And if you've got a little bit of track record with your business and they like you, they trust you, you know, that kind of stuff,
mm-hmm.
then there's really no limit to what you can come up with. Structure.
Yep. I would agree with that. It's a similar model of what we have done through. And I think that there'll be a lot of shops like that in the future, because, you know, they don't have a whole lot of other options. For some of them, their next step is to be in the position like where Jose bought the shop and it was empty for a year.
Liquidate, so, yeah.
So let's move into that burning question that I had mentioned earlier, and that is about the boomers saying, I really would like to get, I'm not ready to buy a branch. My God almighty, I'm enjoying my business. It's been really great. I got a business coach. I'm making more money than ever, but I got to slow down. I got to retire. I got to do something. And I've got a great bottom line, which means I know these people are going to make it, and I'm going to get out. Is that opportunity amongst you in the buzz that you hear in the groups that you're part of, is that like the biggest opportunity? Is the boomers that need a succession opportunity?
I would say, yeah, it's a lot of opportunity in the different groups, but it's not so much the opportunity of the people that you mentioned that are doing well. They have a good bottom line. They have time and they want to slow down. Those people, and I've talked to several of them, they don't generally have a strong reason, you know, to sell their businesses. But it's those that have worked in their business every day and 60 plus hours a week that have no time and they have no money. They're right. Generally the people. But then you have to be very careful about looking at that business is what are you buying? Because a lot of these people are working a job. They're not a business owner.
Yeah, and they also think it's probably worth more than it is.
Right. Sure. But then this is where, something's only worth what someone's willing to pay for.
Exactly.
And, there's a lot of people out there that think that these businesses, they put all of the sweat equity into over the years.
Yeah.
They think it's all worth $1 million. And, it's sad because a lot of them have worked very hard and they should be proud of what they've built. But you take them out of it and what residual value is there is truly a business. So this is going to be a lot of conversation over the years is trying to get these people to wrap their heads around, what is your business actually worth? And it's much less than what they presume it to be.
Right. So, Jeff, you're sitting down with a prospective acquisition and you're looking over the P&L, if there is such a thing.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
And you're trying to make sense to the owner as to what you see. And even if you attempt to normalize the profit and loss statement into something that makes sense to you, here's the income, here's the expenses, and here's the loss, do they understand where you're coming from?
I think they do, but I think that as Andy was saying, there's a lot of emotional attachment. And there's certainly several of the opportunities that we've passed on have been exactly that. A seller that feels like they've got a huge gold mine there and it's who's the lucky person that gets to take over this, for this price, $1 million, $1.5 million, whatever that might be. And, they were not given the right information, unfortunately, on evaluating their business. It's not, like you said, it's not a business unless it can run by itself. So you have to take that into account, and we've walked away from them because of that exact situation.
So each of you around the room, expansion through new locations is going to be the highest opportunity or through acquisition? Where do you think is the primary way we're going to see people growing branches? New upstarts? Or through acquisition?
Where the price is right.
Okay. Very good. Qualified answer.
There's a lot of different, I think there's more opportunities out there available for acquisition, just because there's a lot of shops out there with no exit strategies. So that's going to be good opportunity.
Right.
But it'll be just determining whether you can agree upon a price and it reaches a threshold where you realize, what am I actually buying? I'd rather just start from scratch, instead of buying somebody's problems. It truly has to be an asset. It has to be worth something.
Agree, Jose?
Yes, I think acquisition is a easy way to go. Both of the first shops that I acquired were closed for over a year. There was no goodwill. There was no business to negotiate. It was bricks and mortar. I got in at a great rate with that kind of acquisition. The third location, we were first in in an area that was going to boom. It had tremendous potential. We built new. We bought the ground. We built what I call at the retail level. So a lot of money got dumped into that. We were first into that area, and we are the only entity of its type in that area. But it took 5 years to get that big business off the ground because we were ahead of the curve. The population hadn't really moved in just yet, and they didn't know we were there when they got there. And then when the infrastructure of that area developed, the shopping centers came in, people started discovering us. And now, since we were tenacious and we hung in there, that location is setting records exponentially. It took some time for it to happen. But in my opinion, if you can get in cheap, if you can get in inexpensively through acquisition, you're probably going to have an easier time of realizing a decent profit.
So you would not do a brownfield again?
I don't think so.
Okay.
No, I think the way these guys are doing their business, how they've outlined it, is the similar way that I would approach it too.
Now, Jeff, I know the answer. Your answer is going to be acquisition. I know it. So I want to piggyback on that. you could change it if you want. But if you do say acquisition, give me an idea how long some of your deals have taken from, hi, my name is Jeff Matt.
Yeah.
And let's get together and talk, to when it closes and how you make a deal on a napkin. Give me an idea.
It goes together pretty fast, actually. I think probably weeks where the guts of the deal is together. Once you show an interest, you're typically dealing with a broker, whether it's their broker. Both situations that I've been in, it was the selling broker, and I didn't have anybody representing me, but I could be pretty blunt with them, and they could kind of filter the information back to the seller, because ultimately, you know, they didn't want to upset anybody or whatever. But, you know, that works really well. And but you can put them together pretty fast once you've got an idea what the value is. That's been my experience. And honestly, I think there will be a lot more acquisitions, because one, you can't just put an automotive repair shop up on any corner. So, you know, they're limited in where you can put them up. Mm-hmm. But a good friend of mine and a colleague in my group is in the Phoenix area, and he's actually done a really good job scoping out prime locations, and he has got a phenomenal footprint for a brand new shop facility, efficiently laid out, 6,000 square feet. And I think there's something to be said for that as well, that I wouldn't totally be opposed to that, but you really could compare it to buying a new house or buying an existing house. It's almost identical. There are benefits in both ways. It just kind of depends on, you know, the exact opportunity and really where the buyer is coming from and how much time they've got. Because I think probably the biggest encumbrance for me is the amount of time to get something like that beginning to end, where you can walk into a existing facility that's for sale and close something out, you know, probably within 60, 90 days, be done and ready and rolling, making money and moving on.
So, Jose, competition between shops good?
Yes, I think if it's healthy competition.
Okay.
We have the benefit of developing this network. Each one of the shops are within 10 miles of each other. So there's good camaraderie that occurs. If we have an issue with an automobile and we need knowledge from other technicians, the other shops, they're always willing to help out. As a matter of fact, they love the fact that they can help out in that aspect, either with knowledge or equipment. So we get to share in the success of overcoming an issue with a vehicle. Likewise, with other issues too, with building issues, we have this network we can draw on. Of course, we're always trying to better ourselves every month with our performance. So each shop knows what it's capable of doing.
Their targets, and if when someone hits,
they're like, yes.
Do they grab ass or high five?
Yeah, high five. You know, I mean, that's yeah, and it's always good. And as I mentioned,
depends on the state.
Our big location has had these moments here the past few years, and it's been really, really terrific to see that happen.
Andy, so you have a partner,
and
the name is not Kurtz, but it's another name. Have you embraced helping competition at all between the shops?
Yeah, it's actually you know, not by choice, but one of the new shop that we were in consulting for and then ended up going through acquisition ended up being not as – I would just say not as developed. So there were a lot of resources that we brought over back and forth. But like you had said, Jose, Some of the more senior and more technical staff really enjoy helping. It's like when you're bringing on a new technician, you know, that really gets it. It's like another shop that's under the wing. And also other reasons for expansion was, you know, there's power in numbers, a lot of more resources and information that you can share between. So when you share that communication with the staff, you know, they embrace it as well and appreciate it. And it also opens up a lot of opportunity for them. You know, something early on that, you know, James and I, my partner, discussed was, it would be very unfortunate if we go through and we train this talent and we grow this talent, we pour our heart and soul into them, make them the best that they can be, and then that's it. You know, I don't give them a better opportunity to grow. Well, if I have one location, I have limited growth potential that's there. If I have multiple locations, now there's other growth avenues for those people. So I think it was very inspiring for the talent to see that and say, wow, you know, there might be something more for me with this organization beyond these walls.
You're talking about culture and pride. It senses to me. And you know, Jeff answered that issue about the competition, the support amongst your team.
Well, we don't have really, I wouldn't call it competition necessarily, because really to compete, you have to have two people that really want to push each other. And strangely enough, I don't have that in all my shops. My best manager is actually not very competitive at all. But what we do is we have financial benchmarking, and we have all of our financials side by side by location. So we can certainly hold someone's feet to the fire if they're underperforming in different areas. And it could be from, you know, the gross profit. It could be from sales. It could be from average ticket, or it could be, you know, your Google reviews or email, you know, collection, that kind of stuff. So we use those numbers really against each other, really to our benefit. But the individual locations, we encourage the communication and dependence on each other. But I wish they were actually a bit more competitive. But like I say, you have to have everybody at the top of each of those stores wanting that. And I, for some reason, I don't have that, which is fine. It still works out great, because ultimately, you know, the best, the leader isn't necessarily the one with the title. And, you know, my best, most regularly producing manager is the one that's least competitive.
We've been on 45 minutes, guys. And I'm still not sure how long a good blab is. I do know how long a good podcast should last. And I haven't been able to come close to that lately. 27 minutes and I'm at 30, 35. And this one is at 45. So I'm not sure if someone would actually sit and actually watch a real, you know, live face-to-face here for 45 minutes. So I'm going to kind of try to bring this thing to an end, but we could go on for hours and hours. And then all of a sudden, you know, people fall asleep at their terminal watching this someday and saying, what was I watching? Oh, reruns of I Love Lucy. That's what it was. So I'm going to give you each a last word. First of all, thank you so much for being on. I appreciate this. I know that the podcast listenership's going to really enjoy this. I think it's a hot subject. Each of you are at all so many different levels in your growth strategy. And I appreciate from the bottom of my heart to have done a podcast with me and now done a face-to-face podcast. So I'm going to go around the room. Andy, any last words on multi-shop ownership challenges and opportunities?
Sure. One thing that I would say as far as a challenge and is going from one shop to two, you know, I think that you take a lot of yourself and your skill set and your presence for granted in an organization, and you take that out to invest it into another. You start to realize how much you are really holding a lot of things together. So I'm sure a lot of people listening to the podcast or that will look into it at a later time is, you know, if they're considering growth, make sure that you are ready, but you will probably never, if you wait until you're 100% ready, you'll probably never do it. So processes, procedure. Jose, you mentioned something about replacing yourself. Keep your eyes open and realize everything it is that you do, because if you've done it your whole life, like I have, you just take for granted some items. It's a great opportunity that's out there right now.
So the host always has a chance to break in and say something. I just want you to know that.
Sure.
And what you said inspired me. I read a book. It just takes me to it was by Beckwith. And he said, and I was struggling to get perfect, and doing some things perfect. Mm-hmm. And I was struggling and struggling and struggling. And finally, I bumped across this little chapter in this book that says there is no such thing as perfect. Get good and keep striving for perfection because you'll never get there. Mm-hmm. Which, well, you know, sometimes that holds people back. Says, things aren't right. I can't expand. And you just made a great statement about that. You think you're ready, but you never are. So don't let that hold you back.
Sure.
Great point. Great point. Jose.
Development of your personnel. And I know I touched on this and he brought it up. Andy brought it up again, developing your own replacement. And at one point you'll notice that some of your people also become leaders and great leaders, and they'll actually do things better than how you do them. And to promote that, to amplify that, to let them run with it. Because they are a reflection of yourself and your business. And that's really what grows the business, the culture.
Bam. Bam.
Back to culture.
Jeff, the last word, man.
Last word. Well, you know, I would encourage any single store shop owners out there that maybe haven't considered multi-store ownership to really think deeply about it. There are a lot of pressures on our business. The industry changes. The part stuff that's online that people can get that can affect your margins if you let it, the tires, stores. You know, there's a lot of activity going on out there for these independent store owners, and I don't know how you're going to do it in a single store setting. I think that going forward, the opportunities are going to be huge, and you don't have to look very far. But I would just encourage people, because I didn't think I was going to be a single or a multi-store owner. But it's, if you can do it successfully in one location, you can do it in follow-up locations. And you know, my personal advice is always when you're starting a business, trying to keep your expenses as low as possible. It's going to give you the longest period of time to succeed and to, you know, for your sales to take hold, or you know, the relationships or staff to get formed and all that. So I think that there's just going to be a huge opportunity, I'm trying to build my infrastructure up so that we can grab opportunities as they present themselves. We don't have anything right now that's there that we could do that we're not doing, but it's definitely an aging ownership of repair shops out there. I don't know what the specifics are exactly, but I think we all know that there's a lot of boomers out there that have these businesses and don't want them, and they don't know what they're worth, and ultimately, you can walk into a great situation if the timing is all right and you've got any kind of a history of doing a good job. They all, I've found, have want to turn their businesses over to, and their employees over to, a good next owner. And if you can be that for them and you're at the right place at the right time, there's the opportunity, I think, is going to be huge in the next several years. So
great pointers. Great pointers. Andy, Jose, Jeff, thank you so much. I appreciate it. And we'll watch this online tomorrow.
Sure. Thank you, Carm.
Thanks, guys.
Thanks, Carm. Take care.
Good to see
you
both. Bye-bye. Thanks for being on board to listen and learn from another inspiring aftermarket professional. Until next time.